This is The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. During my latest visit to Florida, I popped into the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. This is where most Air Force, NASA and commercial satellites are launched from. Most of them are not from the adjacent Kennedy Space Center. Now, not very well known is the station's museum. When I was first at Cape Canaveral, you used to be able to drive yourself past the launch pads to the museum. Well, in today's terrorist environment, you have to be escorted onto the base. My tour guide was William Parker.
These buildings are a little bit, this building is a little bit more about the history of the Cape. Obviously, if you're going to launch rockets, they're not always successful. And you want to be as remote from the highly inhabited areas as possible. So here, Florida stuck out in the tip of the Atlantic and in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Vandenberg is ideal for launching polar orbits, where you launch up over the pole and allow the Earth to spin underneath you. And all your Google satellites, your Earth Resources satellites, typically launch out of Vandenberg. Here we launch geosynchronous orbits, or orbits where you can use the spin of the Earth to cast you out and pick up a free bit of energy. And you'll notice that all of your communications satellites are located directly over the equator, where if you're flying at 22,000 miles an hour over the 22,000 miles directly over the equator, you're in an orbit that exactly matches any point on Earth. So if you're at a point on Earth where you're placed in orbit, you stay at that point as the Earth rotates, so you can point your antennas at that satellite. And in the eastern hemisphere, the western hemisphere, you're always looking at it. So as you drive north from Florida, you'll see the antennas, the dish networks, pointing more south. If you were at the equator, it would be pointing straight up. So you can tell why always that the satellites are located over the equator. There are, of course, many exceptions to that. The GPS satellites are in different planes, but there's enough of them. But if you only had one satellite, one communication satellite, you could put it over the equator and talk to that audience without a problem. This building is just a little bit of history. Also, the Cape was prominent for the lighthouse. The Spanish galleons used the Cape as a hiding place for their to get out of the weather when the hurricanes caught them. It's really interesting even that Jules Verne in the 1800s wrote a book called From the Earth to the Moon, and he said that flight would take place on an eastern marshy shore at about 28 degrees north latitude. And you happen to be standing at 28 degrees north latitude on an eastern marshy shore. So he knew something even back then that is hard to believe. This is probably the first practical rocket engine. Actually, there was a small American rocket engine built in Massachusetts in 1926. But within 10 years, the Germans had seen the practicality of it for their purposes and built this engine, a V2 engine, and that's a model of the V2. Every attribute almost of today's modern rocket engines can be traced back to this engine. The turbo machinery, the high speed ability to spin up complex pieces of equipment, the regeneratively cooled chambers and the ablative or recirculating and ablative systems, all of that was developed by the Germans basically from Goddard's small experiment. But by 1936, they were testing these. And as you know, during the war, World War II, they launched some 2,000 of them into Britain. And the only saving grace, or not if you happen to live in the house that the accuracy permitted it or didn't permit it to hit, but they could launch about a 12-mile radius with some degree of accuracy. And it just simply didn't have the guidance and the control systems that we have today. The wall behind you shows a bit of the history that took place after a lot of the focus was off the manned flight. In early on, it was recognized that some form of winged vehicle, which now is well known as the Tomahawk missile, the cruise missiles, if you want to call it, were traced back to this type of experimentation. Unfortunately, again, they didn't have the technology to make them very successful. Trying to put a computer like you saw in the other room and fly it, it just doesn't work. The Snark had the bad habit of flying over the beach and finding the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean right offshore, such that it quickly became known as snark-infested waters. And the Navajo rocket there quickly became known as the Never Go. And several of the others are probably obscene, and I can't repeat them. But they're all related to the fact that they were dubiously successful at best. One thing common to every launch is this console or one just like it. This is the range safety or the command destruct console. And this is the worst job in the world. The guy sitting at this console has to make the decision in split seconds, is the rocket flying correctly or is it going to be a threat to the nearby population centers? And he has typically three ways to determine that. He has onboard telemetry of specific functions that say, yes, I'm flying all right. The rocket tells him it's doing good. He has a radar track to track the rocket that it's flying down the pre-planned corridor. And then he has a visual observer with plain old binoculars standing outside looking at it. And he has to have at least two of the three of them telling him it's flying perfectly, or he pushes the button as it approaches the destruct guidelines. And the rocket itself, they're all slightly different. In this case, he shuts it down as the video you're seeing. He determined that it's going to fall in the ocean, so you can shut the engine down. And the second step is to press the destruct button, and you see a series of those buttons on this console where he pushes the destruct button, and it triggers a shape charge or linear explosive charges, and it literally blows the rocket to smithereens, hopefully in small chunks that can't penetrate the blockhouse if it goes off reasonably close. We were the last recorded mishap that was just across the fence over here. As we go outside, you'll be able to see the Delta launch pad. All of the GPS satellites were launched right across the fence here by the Delta II rocket. And in the middle of the program, the first 24 were built by Rockwell. All 24 were successful. And then the first of the replacement, the rocket went up 1,800 feet straight up before it programmed. One of the solid motors blew up. And it, as well as this operation, they have independent destruct systems. So you might have noticed when the shuttle blew up, one of the solids kept trying to burn. To avoid that, each solid motor has a lanyard that is connected to all the other, and if any one of them starts to go, it blows the whole structure. So there can't be any significant pieces, hopefully, travel any distance from right around the point of launch. Over here is a scale model of the Delta, and the GPS satellite is a 1/4 scale. All of the GPS technology was flown on this rocket with a satellite that looked like that. Nine solid motors, six are lit on the ground, three are lit 60 seconds later in the air. It's an old-fashioned LOX and kerosene burning engine with storable propellants. nitrogen tetroxide, and aerosine 50 if you care, on the second stage, and then a solid motor third stage. And the tiger motif on the nose goes back to the 14th Air Force. 14th Air Force was given the command for launching GPS, and they started the Flying Tigers before World War II in China. And if you remember pictures of the old P-40s, they had the shark's mouth and the shark's eyes. So this there's a lot of history that goes on with this. And this is the longest flying rocket in anybody's inventory. The 15th of the month, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of Delta flying. There's some 290 successful flights. The last 94 have been successful. And it's quite a record. All your Mars missions that you see, the little creatures running about on tracks, those were flown from right over the fence here. The planet chasers and the asteroid impactors were all flown here on that vehicle. And it's got quite a history. It is called the workhorse in space. And unfortunately for this vehicle, there's four or five left. They're being guarded judiciously. Two of them are going to launch for NASA in the next year. And the rest are waiting for a sponsor. But the future will be taken over by the Delta IV and the Atlas V that you probably drove by their launch pads as you came in up the coast. So this bird is going away, but it'll be replaced, and it'll continue. The new replacement will fly two of these satellites at a time. Okay, let's finish up. The first capsules that were flown were the Mercury capsules, the one-man capsule like John Glenn flew in. Wally Schirra and others. This is a Gemini capsule, the first two-man. As you start to progress and look for longer-term flights in space and eventually leading to, at the time, there were several military missions coming up with forerunners of the shuttle, which were canceled, and then ultimately the shuttle. It's interesting that the technology all shows us going back to this design and away from the shuttle type re-landing on a runway. They're going back to a capsule with a heat shield and parachuting back to Earth. And of course, the Russians have never gone away from that. The Russians, all of their manned missions use a capsule similar to this. I believe it's a three-man Soyuz capsule. But this depends on having an ablative surface applied to the blunt end, and as you come around, you can see the flow of the material from the hot spot where the point of entry is, and the material heats up, chars, and then sloughs off, taking the heat with it. So the heat isn't allowed to build up. The heat is just poured off of this, and it leaves a long ionized trail of gas, which caused the communications blackout. If you watched Apollo 13, there was a time when they couldn't talk to them. Well, that's because the antennas and the communications are covered up by this hot gas trailing out behind it. But this is the only capsule that's flown twice in space. And the last time it flew, they took the ejection seats out and they put instrumentation in for doing some more research. So the last time it flew, it was unmanned, but nevertheless, it's one of a kind. And the final bit of the display really was kind of thrown in here as an afterthought, but it just shows the role of space in the Cold War and bringing about the end of the Cold War. The early flights were called Discoverer, where the entire upper stage or Agena stage was put into orbit. And it would fly over potential trouble spots like Cuba or the Soviet Union or Red China, take film packs and expose them of points of interest, and then parachute the individual film pack, much like the monkey's capsule, out over Hawaii, where again it would be snatched out of the air. The pictures downloaded, processed, or shipped in a diplomatic pouch back to the Pentagon. And a week later or so, they would have their pictures. Unlike now, you just look at your dish channel and get an instant readout, or Googling, you can even get 3D. So the trick, though, was how do you take a picture while you're traveling at 17,000 miles an hour at a point fixed on the ground, trying to get something the size of a license plate resolution, and be able to have that good quality. And Kodak actually came up with the process of adjusting the shutter speeds and all of the photo tricks to do that. Until they came along with it, taking pictures from space was a nightmare. And, of course, they didn't have the high-quality television resolution, and which all kind of makes it a moot point now. But and then there were some other satellites that were just up there for monitoring for nuclear testing and not nuclear testing violations. Those have been replaced by, of course, much more efficient satellites. That really is kind of, in a nutshell, the history of the Cape's participation in space. And we certainly thank you for spending part of your day with us. And hopefully we will have a new space museum opened in, right now it's set for July, at the South Gate, which is a different way to enter the Air Force Station as opposed to the visitor center, the KSC side. And we're hoping to have a van at no charge run between that museum and this museum. So you'll be able to just come in and see a part of this. And I also have to apologize. A couple of our big exhibits are down. They're up in the hangar area that you drove past. Fortunately, the good news and the bad news is we got some money, and they're refurbishing them, sandblasting them, applying, returning them to the condition that they were when they were flying. So, but basically, what you see is been here for a good bit of time. We're trying to get it upgraded. And if you want to look at any of the exhibits outside, they won't leave without you. But if one of you is missing, I guarantee you it is really difficult on us because the security people think somebody left the party and is hiding in the bushes. So we do encourage you to get on the bus with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And our guide has been William Parker.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. I thank William for that tour of the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station Museum.